We're reading from John chapter 2 on page 727. And it's a little interaction between Jesus as a 33-year-old and his mother. He's still listening to his mom. All right. John chapter 2, verses 1 to 11. On the third day, a wedding took place at Cana in Galilee. Jesus' mother was there, and Jesus and his disciples had also been invited to the wedding. When the wine was gone, Jesus' mother said to him, "They have no more wine." "Woman," or mom, "why do you involve me?" Jesus replied, "My hour has not yet come." His mother said to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you." Nearby stood 6 stone water jars, the kind used by the Jews for ceremonial washing, each holding from 20 to 30 gallons. Jesus said to the servants, "Fill the jars with water." So they filled them to the brim. Then he told them, "Now draw some out and take it to the master of the banquet." They did so, and the master of the banquet tasted the water that had been turned into wine. He did not realize where it had come from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew. Then he called the bridegroom aside and said, "Everyone brings out the choice wine first and then the cheaper wine after the guests have had too much to drink. But you have saved the best till now." What Jesus did here in Cana of Galilee was the first of the signs through which he revealed his glory, and his disciples put their faith in him. This is the word of the Lord. Farzan, you're up.
Okay, how are you, everybody? Good, good to hear. All right, the story of Jesus turning water into wine, it's a very familiar one, I presume, to you. In fact, it's become so familiar, I think we have largely lost sight of the significance of the miracle. The phrase, turned water into wine, with its iambic trimeter, can be plugged into any line of a pop song, I promise. Referencing, pointing to someone's ability to take the ordinary and make it extraordinary. Out of curiosity, I did a search for water into wine in Spotify and found songs using that line as a lyric or as a title by, wait for it, Bruce Coburn, Leonard Cohen, Loretta Lynn, Kelly Clarkson, Van Morrison, Peter Gabriel, Billy Idol, Bon Jovi, Johnny Cash, the Dave Matthews Band, the Red Hot Chili Peppers, and dozens, if not hundreds, of artists I've never heard of, including Struggle Jennings, who is Waylon Jennings' country rapping grandson. It's a pretty good song, actually, I thought. How about that? Anyway, the point being, it's such a familiar miracle that it is shorthand for either the impossible or the improbable, and its familiarity makes reading this story kind of difficult. We already know what happens, but it's a brilliant little short story that must have been quite exciting to read the first time, especially to people who could identify with the cultural conflict at the heart of the story, making the miracle necessary, and for those people who don't have Jesus turns water into wine as a heading for the chapter in their Bible. So please allow me to go through the story again in the hopes that we can see the way the plot generates suspense and surprise in a very short amount of space. It can be broken up into 4 tidy parts. Verse 1 and 2 sets the scene, what some might call the exposition. Here we learn that in this small, rather insignificant town in Galilee was a wedding. It just so happens that Mary was invited. And as almost an afterthought, we read in verse 2 that also Jesus and his friends were invited. And Mary is discussed as if she is the primary guest, and Jesus just happens to be there too. The second section, the rising action, where conflict surfaces and tension along with it, is told in verses 3 to 8. Wasting no time, John tells us that the wine ran out. We don't know how long into the celebration it took to run out. We also don't know if Mary is somehow important enough to be in the ceremony to be privy to this information before everyone else. But Mary takes the information to Jesus rather than Jesus finding out along with everyone else. He didn't find out when he went back up to the bar for a refill and the bartender told him the news, in other words. Mary seems to have the information before most everyone, so she tells Jesus. But it's almost like she says, isn't that a shame they ran out of wine? Rather than, hey, do something about this, like make some more wine. Jesus responds with two phrases. The first almost sounds like a dismissal of the problem. What does this have to do with you and me? Almost like, this is not our problem, let's mind our own business. But the second response suggests there's more to the story. He says, my hour has not yet come. Very mysterious. What does he mean by that? And what does it have to do with someone else's wedding? Mary either has a sense of what Jesus is capable of doing, or she really is a busybody, like Jesus seems to be accusing her of, and thinks that he can think of something to do. What that is, we have no idea at this point. She just says to the servants, follow his instructions. And Jesus, knowing the futility of trying to ignore his mother's wishes, gives some instructions. He sees some very large stone jars used for ceremonial cleaning over to the side and tells the servants to fill them up with water. There's no mention of how this will fix the problem. Just fill the jugs and take some water over to the chief steward. At this point, the only mention of wine is that there is no wine. There is the sense that something has to change, but the rising action will lead to a climax of the short story, but we don't know what that might be, which leads to the third section, the climax, which is told in verses 9 and 10. The steward tasted the water, and you can imagine his surprise when he tastes the best wine yet. It's so good that he berates the bridegroom for holding out on him, but we, the readers, know more than he does. Jesus told people to fill jugs with water. Water went in, and wine came out. The last verse is what we might call the denouement. The conflict has been resolved. The crisis has been averted, and now we read that this was the first of Jesus' signs, and that sign revealed his glory. And like any good story, other questions are raised that we must read on to find the answers to. The first of his signs, what might that mean? The Gospel of John reads quite differently than the Gospel of Mark, which we read 2 weeks ago. While there is some overlap in some of the stories that the two tell, they're organized very differently to focus on different aspects of Jesus' life and ministry. For instance, John organizes much of his book around seven signs of Jesus, the water into wine story being first. The other signs John narrates are two. Jesus heals a nobleman's son, three. Jesus heals a disabled man at a pool. Four, Jesus feeds 5,000 people with a few loaves of bread and some fish. Number five, Jesus walks on the water. Six, Jesus heals a man born blind. And seven, Jesus raises Lazarus from the dead. After reviewing these seven, I think it's safe to say which are the minor signs. Jesus walking on the water. It's a famous sign, makes it into song lyrics, but it seems kind of like a party trick to me. It's no raising someone from the dead, that's for sure. But turning water into wine, it's also more like something from Penn and Teller, Fool Us, rather than a real miracle. How big of a deal is this, really? Let's just get on with the party. No doubt it's a bit embarrassing, but so what? Do we really need Jesus to waste one of his seven miracles on this tiny issue? Transition to personal anecdote. I couldn't think of anything. 20 years ago, Melanie and I were planning our wedding and we spent a lot of time trying to land on a caterer. It was literally 20 years ago, exactly. No. The wedding itself wasn't until August, but we were planning on it before then, of course. So we were planning on it now. Now, I can't remember who we ended up with. All right, I didn't want to confess this. I was living in Lithuania, so I was not really doing much of the planning at the time. But I don't remember who Melanie ended up with. But we didn't end up recommending them to other people. I'm sure it doesn't exist. It's 20 years. But primarily because they didn't have enough food. My friends from Dallas, that's where I grew up, they have big appetites. And they ended up leaving the reception a few minutes early to go to a restaurant before they closed down. It was kind of embarrassing. I'm still embarrassed about it, I admit. The rest of the reception was great. I do wonder, though, if our paltry servings on napkins ever came up among our guests afterwards, you know, months after. But if it did, so what? The problem with the wedding at Cana, though, is not mere embarrassment. While it may not seem like a big deal to us, it could have had much bigger ramifications for the bridegroom. There may even have been some money involved to pay back the invitees for their inconvenience. One legal text from around the time argues that a gift at a wedding counts as a load and, quote, can be recovered through a court of law. Oh, a loan. Why did I say load? A loan makes more sense. So while not healing a man born blind, there was more to the first sign than just magic or awe. The penalties for running out of wine at your wedding might have been lost over time. Not totally sure exactly what the problem would have been. But it's safe to say that it's not as big of a deal as raising Lazarus from the dead, but it's no small thing either. Now, the other thing we need to talk about is the fact that John calls these miracles signs. The first sign at the wedding is a good introduction to the meaning of these signs. In particular, it is significant that Jesus had those jars filled with water. Those particular jars. They were, according to the text, used for the Jewish ritual of purification, which seems highly symbolic. That is, there is meaning to the sign beyond the miracle that saved the day. The wine was not only the best wine at the wedding, but it highlighted something altogether new in the world. The water in the purification jars points to something greater than the ritual of purification when the water itself becomes greater than water. This was all anticipated at Jesus' baptism. In John's telling of the story of Jesus' baptism, John wants to make sure that though his baptism, that is purification with water, is good, there is something greater. John Baptist says, "I baptize with water. Among you stands one whom you do not know, the one who is coming after me. I am not worthy to untie the thong of his sandal." That is, John the purifier points to something greater than himself. That gives us a clue as to how to understand these signs as a whole. They're meant to point to something else. A sign is not the thing itself, but it points to the thing. So John tells us about seven signs. The last sign, the raising of Lazarus from the dead, is in chapter 11, and chapter 12 is Palm Sunday. It gives us a hint as to what the signs are pointing. A sign is not the thing itself. The water into wine is a sign, and the cross is the thing. Let's look again at the story because it has four words that guide us. There is sign, as we said, glory, my hour, and believe. Well, it says faith in the text, in the NIV. So each of these four words are used more in John than the other three gospels and help us understand the point of the book as a whole. So back to verse 4. We kind of skipped over the most challenging verse when Jesus says to his mother, "Woman, why do you involve me? My hour has not yet come." Most Bibles and commentaries are quick to point out that Jesus isn't being rude to his mother when he calls her woman. That's just how people talked. I also suggested earlier that the question he asked could be pointing out that the wine at the wedding wasn't really his problem. But the next line is a clue to the passage. "My hour has not yet come." A curious thing to say after an observation of "they have no wine." But Jesus is making sure that we understand that what he was about to do was not the entire purpose of his ministry. This is merely a sign. We can see this by tracing "my hour" through the gospel. In John 7:30, we read, "Then they tried to arrest him, but no one laid hands on him because his hour had not yet come." It's very similar language. And in 8:20, just a chapter later, he spoke these words while he was teaching in the treasury at the temple, but no one arrested him because his hour had not yet come. But in 12:23, just after the seventh sign, Jesus answered them, quote, "The hour has come for the Son of Man to be glorified." Glory being one of the other key words in the water to wine story. So in verse 11, the denouement, quote, "When Jesus did here in Cana of Galilee was the first of the signs through which he revealed his glory, and his disciples believed in him," or had faith in him. Which is to say, the signs pointed to his glory, that they would be fully revealed on the cross. Again, this is a sign, not the thing. As wonderful as all the signs are, as much help as they provided, they saved a family from the shame of a poorly provisioned wedding, healed a blind man, feeding 5,000 people. They are signs of God's love and God's glory. They point to the fact that Jesus is one with God. John begins with a declaration about Jesus being made one, or sorry, being, not being made, but being one with God from the beginning of time. Through whom all things were made, without him nothing was made that has been made. Jesus' party trick at the wedding is a sign of that reality. When his disciples saw Jesus' command over the molecular structure of the water, when his disciples drank the most delicious wine after Jesus' instructions, they believed in him. But they did not fully understand what that would mean until the signs were over and the thing itself occurred. On the night Jesus was arrested, he prayed to God a long prayer, which begins, "Father, the hour has come. Glorify your Son, so that the Son may glorify you, since you have given him authority over all people to give eternal life to all whom you have given him." Very soon after this prayer to be glorified, Jesus was arrested for political treason and crucified. There are no mentions of signs pointing to something else. The crucifixion is the thing the signs were pointing to. In his trial, Jesus declares, "My kingdom is not from here." Pilate then asks, "So you are a king?" baiting Jesus into seditious talk. Jesus answers, "You say that I am a king. For this I was born, and for this I came into the world to testify to the truth." Jesus is the King of Truth, and the cross is his throne. What does this mean? Those signs are just tastes of the comprehensive love and power of God. Jesus can save the wedding hosts from the debilitating shame of not having enough wine. Jesus can heal someone from his disability that keeps him from participating fully in society. People are hungry, and Jesus can feed them a meal. But he's not doing these things as a nobleman having pity on the serf. He's not saying, "Let them eat cake." Rather, he's declaring a new type of society altogether where the blind, disabled, hungry, shame, etc., are full participants, equals to the highest in power. The King of Truth has a cross for a throne, and this king was one with God from the beginning of time. But the story isn't over, of course. For the last sign that pointed to the thing was Jesus raising Lazarus from the dead. Again, that was a sign. The thing is the cross, but it is also the empty tomb. The King of Truth cannot be silenced by death. The cross shows that Jesus identifies with the mortals of the world. It shows that the kingdoms of the world are immoral and false. The resurrection shows us just how false they are. Together, they glorify God. Together, they are the thing the signs point to. As has been discussed by the other preachers, we have been tasked with coming up with Christian practices that derive from the scene in the Bible that we're supposed to preach on. Obviously, turning water into wine is not an option as a practice. But there is one other, good luck. I mean, who knows? Maybe it will work. But there is one other key word to the story that is a common motif in the Gospel of John that is something we can practice. We've gone over the keywords sign, hour, and glory, which are all words John uses more than his fellow gospel writers. He also favors believe more than Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Think of John 3:16. Again, verse 11, what Jesus did here in Cana of Galilee was the first of the signs through which he revealed his glory, and his disciples believed in him. Belief in Jesus is something, sometimes the hardest thing for us. I can speak for myself. I know how to read and interpret passages in the Bible. I can derive homiletic insights occasionally from texts, research the minutiae. I enjoy that stuff. But belief can be hard. Perhaps if I were at a wedding, watching the look on the face of the head waiter when he drank what he thought was water only to taste the best wine, then I would have no trouble believing. But people are strange, and belief can sometimes be elusive or temporary. So the practice I'm suggesting is to believe in Jesus as the King of Truth. For some, this might require remembering what first drew you to believe. I imagine some people were at the wedding a couple of years later, hearing about Jesus doing things elsewhere and thinking, "Oh yeah, I saw some amazing signs of God's power over the natural world at Cana. I believed then. Why do I have such trouble believing now?" For others, it might be a bigger step. But belief in Jesus is not only saying to yourself you believe in Jesus. True belief extends to other parts of our lives. For instance, true belief guards against complacency. If you believe that Jesus is the King of truth, then it makes no sense to continue participating in a kingdom of falsehood. Jesus fed the 5,000 as a sign of his glory. It makes no sense then to let anyone go hungry. Jesus had such mastery over the created world as to be able to turn H2O into C2H6O. I have to trust the internet on that one, but plus a bunch of other organic compounds. Then he can just go ahead and fix the planet too, from extra warm weeks like we just had in North America. But it still makes no sense to continue to behave in the way that got us in this position in the first place. True belief also guards against despair. If you believe that Jesus can turn water into wine, then you have to believe that Jesus can heal the world of wars and violence and hatred of others. Jesus can heal the planet of the ravages of the kingdoms of the world, which includes the economic structures that encourage greed and waste, and that have perpetuated against us. And so true belief engenders hope. This is why we meet here each week, not despite the tough times, but because of them. We at the church can practice our belief together, encouraging others against despair, while also healing each other in ways we can, praying for each other and the world, and even celebrating every once in a while as if the wine never ran out.